number 7366, rule number 4.
Colonel Wilde, rule 4. Colonel, you were telling me about General Beresford Pierce.
He was a great character. As I said, he was never seen without a Burma cheroot in his mouth. In fact, he had a second wife, much younger than himself. And I remember asking her one day, did the general go to bed smoking his cheroot? And horrified to get the answer, he stubs it out on going to bed and lights it up with his early morning tea, which duly made us all absolutely horrified. But he was a great character, very much loved by all the troops, and understood the Indian troops completely, and of course the British troops. And I remember it was outside, or at Kerin, when news of his K came through, and I think I was duty officer at the time, if I remember, as I know, I was detailed to send off a telegram to his wife saying, after all these years, I've managed to make a lady out of you. Now, he was very well known and respected.
You mentioned earlier on that you had quite a lot of prisoners of war during the fighting at Kerin, although the fighting was quite bitter. What sort of demeanour did they have?
It's funny you should say that, because they fought very, very bravely indeed, and yet when they were captured, they seemed quite pleased to be captured and out of it all. I think the background of that in their minds was hearing how the war was going in the desert and how they had lost that lot, and they wondered really why they should die in Eritrea. I think that was the background. But it really was the most astonishing theatre of operations. So many things happened there that no one could credit could have happened in World War II. I've outlined some of them already. But I remember, to give you one more example perhaps, an Italian gunner brigadier was captured, and he duly dined, if that can be the expression, on bully beef and biscuits with headquarters RA. He was such a nice man. It transpired that his mother was a Scot. He'd been educated at an English public school, Oxford University, and he was delighted, in fact, to be captured and out of it. But one thing seemed to worry him very much. He said, you will all very soon now be in Asmara. Now there I've got a wife and two daughters, and you know what soldiers are. Now, here is my visiting card. When you get to Asmara, please go and call. They will be delighted to give you tea, and please look after them.
Do you happen to know if they were looked after when the army reached Asmara?
Well, I did not get to Asmara myself, and so I'm afraid I can't give you first-hand information, but George Baker duly took delivery of the visiting card and promised to do his stuff, and if anyone could, I know he would.
Did this Italian brigadier express any political opinions when he was dining with you?
I'm afraid it's a long time ago and I can't remember. The general impression was that his father was an Italian, which is why he was fighting on the Italian side. His whole education, and indeed his interests, were English, and he was just delighted to be out of it, as he didn't really know which side he ought to be fighting for.
Speaking of Italian prisoners of war more generally, one gets the impression that the Italians didn't really have any fundamental feeling of hostility to the British. Do you think that's a fair observation?
Yes, I think it is. Yes, I'm sure it is, because their colonial expansion was all political entirely, And I don't think they are natural fighters, although indeed the ones in Eritrea were the very cream of the Italian army. But I don't think they really wanted to fight there, or indeed anywhere else very much.
Did you find that at Kirin some identifiable Italian units fought much better than others?
Well, the well-known ones, the Savoy, the Bersaglieri, the Alpini, the cream of their units, of course, were outstanding. But if you go right down to the coloured Eritrean troops, they fought just as stubbornly as the Italians. It was a very, very different kettle of fish to what we had found earlier in Sidi Barrani.
You mentioned the fact that the artillery were constantly in action, and you also said that the sappers were always active. What sort of work were they involved in?
I'd like to pay an enormous tribute to the sappers and miners of the division. They were absolutely fantastic in their inventiveness and the multitudinous of tasks which they carried out. I mean, at one stage there was a railway line going all the way from Asmara up to Kassala. It had been completely destroyed by the Italians as they retreated, blocking the tunnels with engines and carriages, and it was completely out of action. The sappers somehow managed to clear the tunnels, and they even got a railway line going, which is not the normal run of line for an Indian sapper and miner. And no matter what you ask of them, they did it. I'd like to pay undying tribute to them. Also to the maintenance services, the S&T, or the ISAT, the Indian Service Corps. They had these tremendous lines of communication, and they were always at it, flogging the road, bringing up supplies, and they really did a wonderful job too. It was very much of a campaign when, I think, no matter what branch of the service you talk about, each one did his stuff quite superbly.
Did the engineers get involved in a lot of assaults for clearing obstacles and that sort of thing?
Well, indeed, and yes, indeed. Every time we came up against a blocked entrance, they had to clear it, and it was always covered in mines, of course. I mean, they did this at Ergodet. First of all, there was a very big block there which they managed to clear. And, of course, Kirin itself, well, I think I mentioned earlier, you just had this one pass through the middle, which was completely covered, filled with debris and blocked. Now, when eventually our infantry captured the high points and enabled the sappers to get at it, under heavy fire still, they worked like mad to clear this and to let our pursuit force through the gap. Yeah, they were terrific.
What sort of mines were the Italians using at Kirin?
I honestly can't remember, except they went off.
How could they actually use them? Because was the ground soft in places, or was it...
Oh, yes, I mean, it was a basically a rocky outcrop, but there are always places you can bury a mine. And, of course, ordinary demolitions and booby traps and everything that goes with it.
Did they have a lot of wire to cover their positions on the hilltops?
I didn't mercifully have to attack the high peaks myself like an infantryman, so I don't think I'm too well qualified to answer that. But obviously there must have been wire. But the top reaches were so steep and with these little red devils, which I've talked about before, you just lean over and pop them down on the advancing infantry, wire would be less necessary there than in most conventional forms of warfare.
Because the terrain itself was an obstruction.
Terrain itself was an obstruction, yes.
I understand that you actually left the battle before it had been concluded.
It was just before Kerin fell, literally a few days before, that news came through that I was to proceed to Haifa to attend a staff college course. And so my long journey began by road to Khartoum, thence by train and by steamer down the Nile to Cairo. I remember on my first evening on the steamer, I was sitting on deck with some war correspondents, people we'd never seen until then, but they arrived at Kerin to put us on the map, and we had taken great pains to show them everything, so they knew everything that we could possibly tell them. And to my horror and amazement, one of them gave me on deck his copy, which he'd written for me to read. And the headline said, I quote, "The Anzacs do it again." When, as the Australians and New Zealanders had not by then arrived in the Middle East, and only British, Indian, and Sudanese troops were in Eritrea, I was not only dumbfounded, but absolutely furious. And the excuse given was this would be a good headline which would go down well in England. Luckily, I had his copy in my hand. I hurled it into the Nile, but what he rewrote, I never knew.
What about the other correspondents? Do you know if they were more responsible in their reporting?
Oh, I'm sure they were. I mean, this was the very early days of the war, certainly abroad for them, and they became the most magnificent people. But I think that this particular one was probably very new to it. It was probably the first campaign he'd ever written up, and he perhaps let his imagination overrule his judgment.
Have you any general conclusions to draw from the campaign?
I think the conclusion one must draw, in a way, is the tremendous admiration one must have for the Commander-in-Chief of the Middle East, Lord Wavell. And there he was, threatened by enormously superior enemy forces in the desert, in East Africa, Iraq, Iran, Syria. He had the most enormous theatre of operations, a very small staff, no political advisor at that time, it was all on his head. He had very few troops, very little in the way of equipment, and yet by his personality and foresight, it was incredible the way he managed to deal with it. I mean, I think at the beginning of this interview I talked about the Western Desert Campaign, and there we were. Had we been allowed to remain after Sidi Barrani, it is possible that we could have had a fairly strong influence in the conduct at that time. But he knew that East Africa had to be won, and won very, very quickly. And so down we went, as did the 5th Indian Division, and that campaign had to be finished very quickly. And it went on, thanks to Kerin, longer than anyone had expected. Directly it was over, and we got through and cleared the port of Asmara, the town of Asmara, and down to the coast at Massawa. Then immediately our division had to be picked up and sent back to the Western Desert to continue fighting as part of the Western Desert Force. I think his vision, his courage, has all the respect possible from those who served under him.